This is tape one, side two, George Tanham interview, 8, 1987. Again, harkening back to this question of interdisciplinary research, one of the things that Rand perhaps saw itself doing better than a university was encouraging this kind of interdisciplinary interaction. So I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts about comparing your situation at Caltech with what was occurring at Rand.
Well, at Caltech, there was essentially no interdisciplinary work. You were a political scientist or economist or a philosopher, and you taught your courses and you did your own individual research. I think at MIT there might have been more of that. It had a much larger social science group there, and they did a lot more research there than at Caltech. At Caltech, there was not really any mention of interdisciplinary work, I can recall. And Rand talked about it, but I talked about it when they actually did it, but it was done sometime, yeah. But Caltech, there was no pretense of doing it.
I guess I'm interested in your comment about Rand. You feel it was perhaps espoused more in mm-hmm. this as
yeah.
philosophy than in practice.
An ideal, yeah. It was done some, but not as much as we talked.
Well, during the period when you were doing this work at Santa Monica, were you involved in what you would call an interdisciplinary project?
No. Well, the Sierra was. I mean, Ed was a mathematician, I was a historian, political scientist, and there were other mathematicians, economists, people like that. Yeah, I guess that was a war game, and a people war game. You know, there was a red team and blue team, and the umpire. That, I suppose, was interdisciplinary in a sense. But it was a lot of, they tried to quantify as much as they could to get some accurate answers, which I didn't think they could do. Well, they could calculate the tonnage of artillery and bombs and things like that, and how fast trucks can go and all that. That doesn't seem to be the guts of war, at least it wasn't then. Maybe it will be.
If appropriate, it might be useful to have kind of a description of a war game for the record, because that's one thing that we really do not have. I'm wondering whether from your experience, whether you could sort of lay out the character and process of a war game that you participated in.
I don't really think I can do it justice at all, because partially I was a consultant. Actually, I was a consultant, and in fact, I was a consultant to the game, only not a participant. And I just can't remember it well enough. I just remember sort of the vague outlines of these. They'd start with a scenario and then try to have an atomic war, or a guerrilla war, or a conventional war, Burma, Thailand. And the details, I just don't remember.
You were suggesting, though, that there were substantial number of factors that figured into how a scenario might develop.
Yeah, and what the factors for victory were. Yeah, they tried to, and I tried to do this in Project Vista. We made a big list of the factors involved in ground combat. You know, all the way from intelligence to geography to weather to leadership, training, weapons, luck, everything we could think of. And, you know, a list of about 20 or 30 things. You could draw up a list in definite length if you wanted. And I think Ed had developed something like that, so you could then sort of have criteria and you could put certain values, and if the ratios at such and such a place were such and such, then that team, that side won or advanced so far. And there were sort of rules of that, but it sort of broke down into guerrilla warfare because nobody understood guerrilla warfare. Didn't apply. Conventional warfare was pretty good. Atomic was the easiest in a way. You just put the cookie cutter down and say, well, everything in this area is destroyed, and 50% outside that's destroyed. And it's relatively simple. Relatively simple. Convention was better understood, of how much a division could cover, what sort of front it would cover, how many miles it could march a day, how many rounds of artillery were likely to be fired, and all that sort of thing. It was fairly well known, at least rough cut that. But when you got down to the warfare that I became interested in, nobody had any figures at all on anything, or even how they fought. I mean, for example, a conventional army is interested in capturing bridges and hilltops and important crossroads and key cities and things like that. And then in conventional wars, forces will fight and die to defend something. Well, guerrillas don't fight that way. They're not going to fight and die if they can help it. They'd run away so they can fight another day. And so the concept of fighting was so different that I think, and we had some retired army officers and all, and they didn't understand it either because it went against the grain. These bastards won't fight. They will stand there and fight, well, so we can kill them. And that's exactly right. They're not going to stand there and let you kill them. They can help it because there are not many of them. They're not very well trained. They don't have any good weapons. So they fight by surprise and stealth and running away and fighting again. And so it was a different notion. I'm not sure the U.S. Army understands it today.
But I think it's during this period when you became actively interested in this problem that the sort of character of warfare was beginning to be understood, and I guess in a broader way, in the sense you had the questions about nuclear strategy, but it began to be seen that sort of underneath this kind of broad strategic question, you could have a lot of this local warfare activity.
Yeah, for a while that wasn't the case. They thought atomic warfare was it. But you're right, it came that, you know, there was sort of a standoff, and other things could happen. Well, they were happening. Korea happened. It wasn't a possibility, it did happen. And Vietnam happened, and French happened, and Algeria happened, and things like that. So it was a fact of life that the atomics were not stopping all war. Stopping some, maybe, but not all. And then people began to go down to the conventional war. And Americans never did really like guerrilla warfare much, but there it was. So you had sort of maybe three trains going at the same time. There was the strategic, became thermonuclear war problems, strategies with the Soviets particularly. And then with Mr. McNamara and others came along, we had conventional war. You got to have divisions just like World War II. That everybody loved that because that was familiar. And then a few people like me were interested in this nasty little warfare that didn't seem to want to go away, and the people didn't stay and fight, and couldn't find them. They didn't have any uniforms. And a few of us got interested in that, and that kept going, still going now. We got a bunch of them going. So there was sort of, this is an oversimplification, but there were sort of three levels of effort at war. Some kind of all going at the same time it ran. I mean, that was one of the beauties. We didn't talk to each other too much because it was a different world.
Before your publication in 1961, were there other publications that ran that you were involved with, or others who dealt with this question of
no
activity?
I think that was the first RAND study on it, I'll be my guess. I actually wrote it, I think, in 58, but it came out as a book in 61.
Try to distribute it at all in 1958 when it was?
Well, it got the usual Air Force distribution, but no response. People said, what is this? But the book sold very well. Just shows you about timing.
Right.
Wasn't changed at all, to speak of.
Right. And what was the Air Force response, say, in
to my study?
In 1961.
Oh, they were pleased. Oh, they were pleased, yeah. Somebody took what we'd done, paid for. Book on guerrilla warfare. I had a chapter on air power. So that was the Air Force side of it.
But there was no further types of discussions about its implications and...
Not at that time, as I remember, no. I mean, but shortly, that's not fair. After the book came out, yes, I mean, Kennedy got everybody into guerrilla warfare and RAND got involved, right. Oh, there's a lot of RAND material written after that. But not much before 1960. I think mine was about the only one. But after that, RAND fell into line with the rest of the country and Kennedy. We put a lot of effort into Vietnam and guerrilla warfare. Lots of work done.
You indicated that you worked with Paxson as a mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
You had some interaction with the economics department.
Right.
Did you have interaction with any of the other departments at RAND?
Yeah, I knew. I got to know some of the physicists for some peculiar reason, and we got along all right. And I got to know some of the, I got to know across the board, I would say, at RAND, engineers, economists. I got to know a lot of the economists. I knew most of them, Albert and Charlie Wolf and Charlie Hitch and all those people. Henry Rowan and Alan Enthoven, a whole group of them.
I'm curious how perhaps this ease of interaction with these people, their availability influenced or stimulated your particular interests or had a role in your interests.
Well, a lot of what I'm saying to you happened after I left Santa Monica, and I became the first RAND liaison officer and director of plans. And in that sense, I represented all of RAND. So people who wanted to see one of the generals or do something there, they would see me. So that meant that engineers and physicists and economists would often, not always, but often come to me for help to get information from plans or to talk to the generals or people like that. So it was in that job that I really began to make a number of acquaintances across the board in RAND. When I was in Santa Monica, it was considerably more limited. I knew some of the physicists and some of the economists, but, and a few others, but not that many.
Okay. Well, perhaps it's appropriate to move on to this position you assumed.
Yeah, we'll never get to even the 60s, much where we're going.
Well, I think what we're getting, though, is very useful.
All right.
You indicated earlier you were not clear why you were selected for this sort of position,
no.
Given the limit. Context that you'd had previously.
Larry Henderson came to my office after lunch one day and said, how would you like to go back to Washington? And I said, what for? He said, well, General Kerry has agreed to have a RAND liaison, and I think you should be it. Well, I didn't hardly know Larry Henderson at the time. And I said, well, I like the East. He said, well, come back to Washington next week and meet General Kerry. I said, okay. So I did. So I met Kerry, who was kind of a formidable guy, but he seemed to like me all right, so I was chosen for that job. So this was in November at the board meeting time, and end of December I drove back here with my family and went to work in January for General Kerry. That was great. That was another great year in my life. Kerry had collected some of the best brains in the Air Force, no doubt about it, as I will demonstrate in a minute. And they were majors and lieutenant colonels, a little bit older than me maybe, but not a hell of a lot. And in those days, the director of plans was the key man in the air staff. I mean, it was the point where the NSC touched base with the Air Force, with the Joint Staff, State Department. And it was sort of the nerve center of the whole air staff. Everything had to have a director of plans, chop, as they would say, or approval. It had enormous power, this two-star general. And so it was a very exciting place to be. And General Kerry couldn't have been nicer to me. He called me one day and he said, now, Junior, he called me Junior to Henderson. And he said, I'm going to give you the run of this place. And there's a lot of very sensitive material in here, and I've told my people to show you anything you want to see, no matter what it is. But he says, a lot of it you cannot send to Santa Monica, and you have to know that, and you only get one mistake. And I said, I understand what you're saying. He said, okay, that's it. You get the run of the place. But about a week later, he had a dinner party. He had all the generals in the office. There were about three generals in plans and a couple senior colonels. And said, no, George has joined us to RAND, and we think RAND can help us. And of course, we have to help him help us. And I want you to treat him just as though he's got on a blue suit and part of the team. And they did. And I had a wonderful year with him. Paxton was going to brief his study, the Sierra studies, out to SINCPAC in Hawaii and a guy named in Japan. And the request came in, and Kerry called me, and he said, Junior, you tell Rand that they can send Paxton under one condition, that you escort him. I said, I can't do that. He said, well, he ain't going then. He said, you want me to go watch Paxton? He said, yes. So I told Paxton, he and I were friends. He said, well, fine, George, I'd love to have you along, no problem. So I went with him. That was my first visit to Vietnam, 1958. But he trusted me, came to trust me, and figured I'd keep. I don't know really what he's worried about Paxton doing, but something was on his mind. Well, I had a great time with Ed. He and I were good friends. We weren't any problem.
Before you assume this liaison mm-hmm. position, how did this kind of function get handled?
Didn't very much, I guess. That was part of the problem. See, Larry sort of did it for the whole Air Force. And I think we'd had a liaison in the Director of Requirements. But as I told you, plans became, or was, very important. And it dawned on some people that, you know, we had to have a better relationship with plans, because they were very, very powerful in the air staff at that time. And I don't know how this came off. I really don't. I never, like, if I asked Larry, he didn't tell me, or I forgot it or something. But anyway, it was decided, I think, between Larry and John Kerry. Both of them were very bright, and they got along pretty well, that it would be useful to have a RAND guy there to help the flow of information which we needed for some of our studies. You could get most of it from plans, particularly the sensitive stuff and the political here in Washington as well as the political abroad. And that RAND, this would also get RAND into the Directorate of Plans, where we could get our studies with better exposure and all that, I-range briefing and things like that. So I think that Henderson and Kerry saw this need, and I don't know how Larry picked me up to this day. But it was a great year, and I got to know all these guys, and most of them turned out to be 3- and 4-star generals.
What was your standing in the social sciences department when this happened?
Were you just I talked to Hans Barney. He said, fine, go away for a year if you want to. I mean, I was a member in good standing, but I was a rather junior one. Most of them were somewhat older than I. But Hans said, fine, if you want to do it. And I thought he thought it was a good deal for the social science department. So I was going to be in a key slot. I liked the social sciences. I liked Hans, and so they thought that was a good deal. Social science was recognized. You know, I was sort of the first one in the, I suppose you'd call it, administrative structure. So they seemed to think it was a great idea. I came too, after I'd been in there for a month or two. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Had a wonderful time. Learned a lot. I learned a lot about how the Air Force works, how the Pentagon works, Congress, the whole Washington scene. It was a great experience. I'm very grateful to Kerry, who died a few years ago.
It sounds like was he fairly personally involved over this year that you've been
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, he invited me to sit on all the briefings and meetings, and, you know, with the same rules, unless you can't tell anybody. And in his abrupt way, he was very kind and considerate to me. I had an office right outside his office with the exec. No liaison office has been out there since. Not in a position like that. No, he gave me a very special place. And as I say, he created an office out where the secretaries and the deck were for me. And he let me see everything, sat in all the briefings, all the papers, all the JCS papers, which I technically shouldn't have seen. So, you know, he really did give me the opportunity to make the most of it, and I tried to.
I'm a little unclear in the sense that he...
What I did? No, what he...
For his caveat that you were not to share some mm-hmm. of the things that you came across.
Well...
How would they then be useful to Rand if you had to sort of keep them close to the vest?
Well, some of them wouldn't. Some of the things I couldn't tell Rand. But usually I could disguise it. I'll give you an example. Something would come through in a joint paper. Now, even I wasn't technically supposed to see it, but Kerry said, I could see it. And I could see what was happening down the Joint Chiefs. We would be doing study related to that. So what I would do, instead of saying, I've seen a joint paper, I would say, I've been talking to people in plans, and they have this view about these points that I think are relevant to your study. And that, you know, there were mostly ways around it. Now, if it was a specific identifiable point, then I had to be very careful. And sometimes he would tell me, one time he called me and he said, I'll give you the answer to this in a minute, a very high person has asked 4 questions. And I'd like your bright guys at RAND to help me with them, but you cannot identify the person. He said, just say it's a high person. So that's what I did. I said, a very high official has asked these 4 questions. And General Kerry would like your help with them. Well, I got about 15 calls the next day. Every single one said, who is the high-level person? And I said, I can't tell you. And why are we not going to do it? I said, well, it's up to you. I said, I think it's important that we make this contribution. Kerry has asked us to, and if you're going to hold up on your on a minor little point of you got to know who it is before you answer, you know, that's not very good of us. Well, finally we did come in, but there was President Eisenhower's questions, but he didn't want it known, and the secret was kept. But I finally got some help out of RAND. So there were ways to do it.
Yeah. From what you're saying, I get a sense almost of divided loyalty.
Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
Like
you had to. Yes, you did. I mean, I never forgot that I was working for RAND and all that, but sometimes I could certainly sympathize with the director of plans. And I knew I couldn't make any mistakes, and that wouldn't help RAND either. So a lot of the stuff I just, to be on the safe side, disguised it. Maybe that wasn't right, but that's what I did.
Perhaps this is a naive question, but let's start there. What was your perception during this time of how the Air Force wanted to work with RAND?
That wasn't too clear. See, because the planned people really hadn't worked with RAND very much. And this was an effort to get more interaction with plans. Because RAND started out sort of doing hardware work, and that wasn't with plans. Plans had nothing to do with hardware weapons. They were ideas and plans and policies and things like that. And as RAND broadened with the social scientists and the economists, of course, then we got into that field of policies and ideas more than just inventing weapons or how you use them and that sort of thing. So, and I think there's still a problem with plans today of how they use RAND. Also, in some ways, RAND became competitive with plans in some of these areas of ideas or policies and things like that. We would suggest policies which plans might have other ideas about. So there was a touch of rivalry, because we really weren't rivals. It was a little competition sometimes. And the plans people would occasionally say, you know, who the hell I think they are out here? We decide on the plans, or we decide on the policy. And the RAND people would say, well, those dummies and plans, they don't know what they're doing. And they don't take our ideas. And so, you know, there was some tension, I would say. Because as we got into these areas, we were, in a sense, competing with them. And they'd been kingpins and didn't really like any competition. And then it got even more complicated with something I suppose we'll get to sometime. We began to work for ISA. Well, ISA, in a sense, was kind of the plans of the Secretary of Defense, if you know what I mean. They were the strategy, the international relations, political aspect of the Secretary's office, just as plans was for the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And when we went to work for the ISA, I mean, the plans was just bitterly opposed. They just saw that as the enemy, the third floor where the secretary was. That was the enemy. They were just wild, in spite of what the people will tell you at RAND. The director of plans was Dave Birchall, and he was bitterly opposed to us working for ISA. You will get another story from the rest of RAND, but I was at the meeting. Larry Henderson and I went over to see General Ferguson, who was the DCS for R&D, Research and Development, Jim Ferguson, to discuss this matter, and Jim had invited Dave Birchall, and I sort of, we had other RAND liaisons, but I kind of stayed there even after I left because I had so many friends. And we went, Larry said, come along because you know Dave Birchall. And Larry explained that we were going to have this contract with ISA and what it would involve, and asked, what do you think? Well, Ferguson said, well, Larry said, you know, you're a private corporation, and I really can't tell you what to do. If you want to do it, I guess you can do it. He said, what do you think, Dave? Dave says, we're bitterly opposed, absolutely opposed. ISA is, he didn't, I don't think he said the enemy, but he might as well have.
This is, with these kinds of, I'm wondering, you obviously, you worked with Larry Henderson at this time.
Yes, Larry and I worked together very closely, and I think very well.
And he was aware of this kind of understanding that you had with Kerry about how you would conduct yourself in the job.
I'm not sure. I told him. Though I did at times tell him that there were things I couldn't tell RAND. I'm not sure I ever said, you know, Kerry said, well, you're George here under certain conditions that you can't, that if you violate them, you're out. I'm not sure I ever told him that, but I did tell him, I said, you know, Larry, there are things, and he understood that. He didn't really give me a hard time with that.
And in this position, what was your relationship with top management back in Santa Monica? Did you have contact with
them? Yeah, that's when I began to have contact with Frank and Dick Goldstein, right? And the department heads and all that. Because it was seen as an important slot. And so, yeah, I began to have very wide contacts.
But how did you sort of characterize your situation to them? I mean, you're generally kind of on a day-to-day basis with this question of sensitive information.
No, it didn't come up much, you see. I, in fact, I tried never to bring it up, but it didn't come up much. I mean, most of the people didn't know or didn't care that I was that way because I got a lot of good information. But the point is that we can concentrate on what I couldn't say, but there was so much that I could that it was helpful to most of the people. I mean, they wanted, what does the Air Force think about this, or can you get me that document? I could do it, and I could do it fast. So most of the people, I think, you know, were reasonably happy that I was being helpful to them. And they didn't concentrate on the things that they didn't know they didn't know.
Fair enough. That's a good point. Okay. Balance here.
Right.
But I'm interested if you know what either Dick Goldstein's or Frank Kolbaum's perceptions were of what you should be doing in this position.
Oh, I think both of them certainly knew. I mean, well, let me step back a second. Nobody ever told me what the job was. They just said, this is, you'll be the first RAND liaison in plans, and that was it, period. And I was under the impression that the job was what I made it. And one of the purposes, it was very clear to me, of course, was that I was to get information that would be useful to RAND researchers. And I would do that in a general sense of sending out papers that I thought would be of interest to RAND to a number of people. Then as I was there, people realized they could use me. They'd call up and say, can you get me something on this? And I could. And I think by the time I'd been there 6 months, that people realized that I was helpful and the slot was a useful one because they filled it when I left. And I think, I know that Frank appreciated this. And, you know, it just didn't come up much. This thing we've dwelt so much on didn't really come up that much. Partially because I never brought it up. And partially because it didn't really happen that often. Now, I did see the JCS stuff all the time. And I just didn't pass that on. But everybody, I think, at least tacitly understood I couldn't fool with that much. But I would protect RAND from a grievous error by one way or another. Disguising something or whatever. Yeah.
question to, the reason that I found it interesting in pursuing mm-hmm. a little bit was this question of a sense of kind of a dual commitment to both.
Oh, I think when you're if you do a proper liaison job, you do have that. Oh, yeah, I think that's true. You do. But the fortunate thing is that it doesn't arise as a real problem very often. I mean, we were working to help the Air Force, and the Air Force is working to help itself. And we would differ occasionally, but on the whole, we were working toward the same objective, to make the Air Force positions in the JCS better, or to make the Air Force presentations on the weapon system better, and that's what they were doing. Now, we disagree sometimes pretty violently on the way to do that, but the objectives were the same. We were trying to help the Air Force be a better Air Force. And that makes a difference.
You did indicate this certain tension within the director of plans about RAND contribution. Was this just like
a... Not much. Yes, there was some, but again, that was the exception rather than the rule, and not very frequent. There was a little sensitivity now and then that who the hell are they? What do they think they're doing? But it wasn't widespread. Well, there were a few people. There were a few people that didn't like it, but most of the people were quite balanced about it, I thought.
Did you have occasion to go back to Santa Monica and just participate in these management committee discussions?
Sometime. Yes, no, I went back to Santa Monica frequently because some of it was just easy to go talk to people. And so I went back, I would guess once a month, yeah. And I would meet with Frank and Goldie and department heads and just researchers. Most of my work was for researchers, but sometime Frank or Goldie would want to know something. What did the Secretary of the Air Force think? Well, that was the easiest place to get it in plans. Because they knew all that. They wrote his things, wrote his papers and that sort of thing, a lot of them. So yeah, there was a close interaction, and I stayed in close contact with RAND by going out there frequently and telephone, of course. And they came to here and come to see me in the Pentagon. I didn't feel uncomfortable at all in the job, if that's what you're getting at. And I didn't feel that there were really very many occasions when there was any sort of tension between my loyalties. There was occasions when I wouldn't tell people things that they wanted to know, but there wasn't a hell of a lot of that.
Did you play a role in sort of relaying Air Force interests mm-hmm. Where they want mm-hmm. RAND to focus?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, I tried to. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was fortunate in establishing a very good relationship, because even after I left, I remember one time Dave Burschel, we had a liaison after me there. Dave Burschel called me and said, George, what do you think the world's going to look like in 10 years? I said, I haven't got the clue. He said, we got all those bright guys' ideas. Why don't you get RAND to do me a piece in a couple of weeks on what it'll all look like in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and all. I said, what do you want, Dave? He said, 3 weeks. I called Santa Monica and they just threw up their hands. I said, you're out of your mind. I said, well, you know, you guys, you talk about you're experts in Southeast Asia, and now somebody says, well, you know, what's it going to look like? And you say, oh, I can't do that. Well, how good are you? History didn't do us any good. So I talked with them. They finally said, well, okay, it won't be much. We can't possibly do it in 3 weeks. And I said, well, you have to. Turned out they pulled themselves together. My God, they wrote 2 volumes like this. And it wasn't bad. And a couple of them called me up later and said, you know, George, if we'd had 2 months, we wouldn't have done any better. And they really pulled themselves together, and they did an interesting thing. But they were a little cajoling and all, but they did. And I think they really all kind of enjoyed it. This was mostly social scientists, of course, too.
Yeah. Well, that raises an interesting kind of question, and that is this sort of balance between the need to do kind of long-term research projects.
Right, that's the real problem, yeah.
short turnaround requests.
Well, I was able to protect RAND from a lot of that. I mean, that's one thing I did help with. I'd tell Kerry, I said, you know, that's not for us. the way your staff officers do that. That's not for us. So that I more than Rand realizes I stopped a lot of that. But like Birchall's request was sort of intriguing because it appealed to me. I thought it was a good question. Let's see what they can say. But you're right. I mean, I kept trying to explain to John all that these quickies were not for us. That's what a staff was for. We were to look at the long range further out into the future to try to see what the problems would be, or to look at them in more depth, you know, dig a little deeper into them. And he generally accepted that. I had to give in sometime, but he kind of appreciated that. He was a very able man.
I'm very interested in the story because it sounds like as an individual you had to develop, or you sort of had some innate qualities that allowed you to work with a lot of political sensitivities, if you will, in this kind of position.
Yeah, it turned out, I think, I would not have predicted that I would have, but I did seem to, and I made a lot of my best friends are still people I met in that year. And I was sensitive, very sensitive, as it turned out, I think, to what their sensitivities were, so I didn't make any mistakes of a major kind that Kerry was worried about. Yeah, you did have to be very sensitive to the sensitivities of the Air Force vis-a-vis the Army, or vis-a-vis the Navy in particular, or the third floor, as they called it, the Secretary's office, and the NSC, and State Department, CIA, because plans worked with all of them. And there were little spots there people couldn't go to see. You're right. I mean, it did take a person who wanted to understand these sensitivities and nuances. And I turned out to do that reasonably well, I guess.
I'm wondering whether, as you started the job, you said it was yours to mold. Did you kind of consciously go about educating yourself in a particular way, or was it a question of immersion and you learned?
Just immersion, yeah, it was sort of immersion, total immersion. I was thrown into plans, and they were working like hell for 14 hours a day. So, and then they would, maybe I could help myself or get help from Santa Monica, and you know, just quick help, call the phone and say, what is this? And people would do that. I had to do a fair amount of that to get some brownie points. I mean, to get some trading points there. And I had to show them that Rand could be helpful for them today, not just 2 years from now when they'd be out in the Pacific somewhere, another assignment. And the Rand people were very good about that. Most of them liked to be asked to help. And a few would say, don't bother me, but most of them would say, right, get you something today at 2 George. And that was very important to making Rand acceptable. Because, you know, it's all well and good to talk about 2 years from now, but most of those guys aren't going to be there. Not going to happen on their watch. So it was important to get some short-term help, to earn the possibility of taking the longer-term stuff.
In addition to getting the short-term help, I also get the impression there was sometimes a need to kind of interpret or summarize.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh yes, definitely, definitely. That's that became another important point of doing exactly what you said, because the language was sort of different between the researcher and an Air Force officer. Different lives, different training, different background. So there was the interpretation, I think is the right word. I did have to interpret some of the RAND work and interpret to RAND some of the Air Force concerns or questions or what have you. Yeah, there was a lot of that. A lot of that. And coaching the RAND people a little bit. Now when you go brief General so-and-so or Colonel so-and-so, he's like this. He won't put up with this. He say it this way. Don't hesitate. You know, lots of little tips like that which help get the message across or help the conversation go along easier. Because you could walk in the cold to somebody and just turn them off like that, and that would be the end. So I think I was helpful in that, too.
One aspect of the RAND enterprise that I find very interesting is you've got this body of researchers out of Santa Monica in a best scholarly fashion trying to come up with an answer to a question or a problem. And then you've got this either problem of having it interpreted to the Air Force,
right,
or more boldly selling it to the Air Force.
Right, that's right, selling it to the Air Force. There was also another aspect to it, which I wasn't too successful about, and that was I kept telling Rand, timing is important. If you can get this study in a certain phase in the budget cycle, it'll have enormous impact. If you get it in 2 weeks later, it's gone for a year, so forget it. But they didn't understand the sort of the cycles in Washington. They didn't want to get involved in that, and maybe they were right in a sense, because you don't want to get involved in all of Washington. You lose the point of being out of it in California. But I used to think, and I tried, and sometimes it worked, but I didn't do very well, that urge people to get this in a little earlier, as you hit the cycle, right? And then they'll take it as an input and use it. As I say, a few weeks later, it's not going to, they'll forget it, next year's an old study. Now, some time didn't matter, too. A lot of them time didn't matter, the kind of work we did. But some did.
The things that you're saying to me seems like an extraordinary education to pick up in the course of a year. It just,
Yeah, well, it was a fun year. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. When you're enjoying it, you learn a lot. And as I've told you, you know, I did, in spite of the fact that we had liaisons, I had made so many friends that I was sort of a secondary liaison officer for a few years with my friends. And when I was Larry's deputy later, I sort of was in charge of all the liaisons. We used to have about six liaison officers here. And I met with them once a week in my office, showed them somebody was interested in them and what they were doing. So I really kept my hand in a sense, and I would go out to the Pentagon myself three or four times a week to see people on something. It was across the board, or somebody wanted to see me, or something like that. So I don't think I learned it all in 1 year. But I learned a lot in 1 year.
Another aspect of it is, and I think we just touched it briefly, is this question of helping to arrange the briefings when a study was at that stage.
Right. Well, it wasn't very complicated. The guy would tell me that he'd finished his study around, he'd like to come in and brief it. And in those days, we had the last dry run of a briefing was here in the Washington office. If we didn't like it, it got sent back. They don't do that anymore. So I would say, okay, bring it in. And I would sort of wait till I'd heard it, till I decided sort of at what level I would start, or where exactly. And a lot of the studies, you know, really weren't for generals. So I would start with the working level majors and lieutenant colonels. And if it went very well, we'd go up to a division chief. That'd be a full colonel, say. And they might decide, or together we'd decide, well, maybe a brigadier type would hear it or something like that. So part of it, you sort of alerted people that the briefing was coming, but sometime I knew the study well enough, I'd talk to the guy, so I knew that, yes, General Kerry would like to hear this. But I'd usually brief his staff first so they knew about it. And then they would sit in with Hing and I could explain things or something like that. It was very helpful to have them heard it first. And then if Kerry liked it and we'd talk about it, John and I would talk about it, well, we'd say we'd send it up to the next level, the three-star level maybe sometime. General Gerhardt when I was there, Johnny Gerhardt. And we'd try to get on his schedule. And all these people were very busy people, so you sometimes couldn't do it as quickly as you'd wanted to, but sometime you could. And, you know, sometime the researchers didn't agree with me. They thought they should go right in and brief the chief. And I tried to explain how to operate in the staff, and sort of you went up the echelons. But, yeah, I arranged a lot of briefings, and I could cross them over into other directorates, which also might be interested.
Let's pause for a second. I'm at the end of the tape.
Okay, we're getting into the session, aren't we?
this is the end of the George Chanham interview, 8/1986.
All right.